The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 42, A Biographer's Burden, Deconstructing Robert Remini's Joseph Smith and Will Bagley's Brigham Young, by Newell G. Bringhurst, with a response by Will Bagley.
Okay, let's begin.
John, would you do
it? Sure. Oh, yeah. After I introduce you, we'll do that. Welcome to session number 42 at the 2003 Sunstone Symposium West. The title is A Biographer's Burden, Deconstructing Robert Remini's Joseph Smith and Will Bagley's Brigham Young. Our main presenter will be Newell Bringhurst. I always feel very grateful to have Newell involved in Sunstone. He's very good to us, and he does a lot of good things for us. Also an accomplished biographer himself, he wrote just the absolutely magnificent Fawn McKay Brody, A Biographer's Life. He also wrote a volume on Brigham Young. He wrote the well-known Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, and has done tremendous scholarly and historical work on the church. Our response will be by Will Bagley, who was good enough to respond when I called him, you know, but was probably like an hour ago. And I guess it was Tuesday. Will wrote a little book called Blood of the Prophets. You may have heard of it. it's garnered incredible attention, including from the New York Times Book Review and many other quite prestigious publications have reviewed it quite favorably. Will is also the editor of the Kingdom in the West series, which is probably not as well known as Blood of the Prophets, but in my estimation is just as phenomenal and an important work. He is the editor at the Prairie Dog Press, and according to what Dan decided to insert at the last minute, he is a newlywed as well. So our congratulations to Will. Let's turn the time over to Newell Bringhurst.
Well, I apologize, first of all. I guess his phone's picking up okay. I apologize, first of all, to Will for the fact that he didn't get a copy of my remarks beforehand. We've talked a little bit about the book and that, but my focus on today is not going to be on the overall study, but on his portrait of Brigham Young. I thought he'd give it a little bit different perspective. But I'm also going to do it in tandem with a critique of Robert Remini's Joseph Smith, the biography that's part of the Penguin Live series. How many of you have read that or have seen that book, the Joseph Smith biography? Let's see your hands. It's an important work, and it's an interesting work. And so, you can decide after you listen to my remarks whether you want to purchase it or not. Those of you who haven't purchased it, and how many of you have looked at Will Bagley's book and read it? I guess about the same number. I guess you make the same decision. Maybe we'll sell a few books for Will here anyway. But over the course of the past year, I've had the opportunity to read and review two significant books: Robert Remini's Joseph Smith, A Penguin Life, and Will Bagley's Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows. I must confess that the two reviews I wrote, one for each book and each for a different publication, were extremely brief and perfunctory, necessitated by space limitations. Will, you want to hold up the copy of the review? I mean, it was just very, very, very brief. I mean, they limited like 150 words, and all had to be one on one side of the page for the Journal of the West. And so I feel that that this really prevented me from doing full justice to the importance of the two books. I confess at the outset that I am most favorably impressed with both books. Each provides fresh illuminating insights into their principal subjects, namely Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, thereby advancing the craft of Mormon biography. Although I'm not going to let Will off the hook, I do find deficiencies in both, which I will point out as I get into my presentation. Both books, I should point out, received nationwide attention, including reviews in such prestigious publications as the New York Times and the New York Review of Books. Such widespread notice would seem to suggest a coming of age. of Mormon historical scholarship. Indeed, the fact that non-Mormon Robert Remini, a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and nationally renowned Jacksonian scholar, would choose to write on Joseph Smith would seem to lend credence to this coming of age. Remini, noted for his definitive multi-volume biography of President Andrew Jackson and winner of the National Book Award, so you can see this guy's really high-powered, has produced a compelling and on the whole sympathetic biography of Joseph Smith. Despite its brevity, totaling a mere 190 pages, a limit imposed by the constraints of the Penguin Live series, of which the biography is a part, Remini manages to skillfully place the Latter-day Saint leader within the context of Jacksonian American society. I feel like this is one of the greatest strengths of this book, because so oftentimes Mormon scholars, we tend to write for other Mormons and we don't put it within the broader context. And I think this is really a big strength of Remini's book. To a large extent, and I'm quoting Remini here, Smith and his church were products of a uniquely American milieu. The Jacksonian age, with its democratic trust and reach for perfectionism, provided the conditions and impetus for sudden and massive change. Remini, I feel, is even-handed and empathetic in presenting Joseph Smith as the religious leader he claimed to be. And I think revealing here are the words of Remini, the way he approaches his biography. After considerable thought, I decided to present Smith's religious experiences just as he described them in his writings, and let readers decide for themselves to what extent they would give credence to them. I am not out to prove or disprove any of his claims. As a historian, I have tried to be as objective as possible in narrating Joseph's life and works, unquote. Utilizing this approach, Remini effectively discusses Joseph Smith's background, specifically his family's strong religiosity, their economic difficulties, and other adversities. Remini devotes significant space to Joseph Smith's early life, devoting 74 out of the 190 pages, to Smith's activities prior to 1830 and the formation of the Mormon Church. This represents 40% of the text, and I sort of like that, because in biography I feel like a person's personality and character is formed in the formative years, and I remember that was one of the things I tried to do in my both my Brigham Young biography and also in my Fawn Brody biography, because so those early years are so critical, and so I give Remini praise there. And there, Remini provides keen insights, I feel, as a result, into young Joseph's behavior and complex personality. The youthful Smith, according to Remini, was, and again I'm quoting Remini, a quick-witted, ambitious boy, gifted with soaring imagination, who demonstrated a talent for leadership and a personal need for attention and recognition. He was an outgoing and gregarious young man when playing or working with his friends. But at home, in the quiet of his room or in the fields out of sight, he was self-absorbed and intently concerned about the salvation of his soul. His mother said he was much less inclined to read books than any of her other children. Like his father, he was far more given to meditation and deep study, unquote. Remini is also particularly engaging in his vivid account of five-year-old Joseph's bout with typhoid fever, a condition complicated by osteomyelitis. This is a serious bacterial infection of the bone and the bone marrow in his leg. The young boy was compelled to go endure the trauma. You know, with this story that we've all heard and, we were brought up with, the young Joseph was compelled to endure the trauma of intensive surgery. A team of surgeons from nearby Dartmouth College removed chunks of the diseased bone without anesthesia to save his leg. With perceptive insight, Remini theorizes concerning both the short and the long-term consequences of this ordeal. I think he's very invocative the way he describes it, as follows. What emotional and psychological scars he carried into adulthood is impossible to state with certainty. But surely the illness, the excruciating pain he suffered for months, and the limp he developed must have had a tremendous psychological impact on him and on the type of person he became. It is entirely possible that it conditioned him for the career he chose and the suffering and persecution he later endured. It may have even focused his attention more sharply on the afterlife, unquote. Remini succinctly describes the facts that made, the factors that made Joseph Smith a successful religious leader. Joseph, in the words of Remini, demonstrated remarkable administrative skills in establishing the LDS Church, shaping its focus and guiding its future direction. As a religious leader, moreover, Smith was sensitive to the mood of the Second Great Awakening of the early 19th century, when citizens wanted preachers who could rouse their emotions and offer them dramatic evidence of their faith and commitment. Smith fits into this mode with perfection. Smith, in the words of Remini, projected, and again I'm quoting Remini, a new voice, a dramatic voice, a certain voice, a voice that throbbed with conviction and seemed to many to be divinely inspired. He claimed direct and frequent communication with God, and the people believed him. He offered to ordinary citizens, especially the poor, a sense of self-worth, a sense of belonging in a constantly changing world, one in which the future seemed so uncertain. His followers found an identity in a community of other believers. They found meaning and direction in their lives. The Mormon Church met some of their deepest psychological and emotional needs because to them it offered a guarantee of truth. I think he says a lot in that paragraph, and it's kind of evocative. I think this prose, I mean, he's really a wordsmith. I think that's one of the things I really like about him. There's a cadence there to his prose and the way that he presents it. Smith, moreover, and again I'm quoting Remini, was a man of compelling charisma, charm, and persuasiveness, a man absolutely convinced that his religious authority came directly from God. At the same time, however, Remini does not ignore the negative aspects of Smith and his personality. He carefully outlines the many and varied reasons why Joseph and his Mormon brethren were hated with such intensity as to provoke mob violence and murder. Foremost among these was Smith's contention that all other religions and their preachers were corrupt and abominations in the sight of God. Also, considered outright blasphemy to non-Mormons were Smith's claims that he was a prophet, that he spoke regularly to God, and had brought forth another Bible, the Book of Mormon, that provided the true story of the lost tribes of Israel. To make matters worse, the Mormon religion, in the words of Remini, seemed to make a mockery of fundamental Christian beliefs. Again, I'm quoting Remini. With such teachings as polygamy, baptism for the dead, a plurality of gods, that mortal men and women could become gods themselves, and the concept that God the Father, once being a man, passed through a stage of mortality before becoming a god. Also engendering hostility, according to Remini, were economic factors. Either Mormons were criticized when impoverished because they placed an insupportable burden of pauperism on the community, or when prosperous, they aroused the jealousy and resentment of those less fortunate. Intolerance towards the Mormons frequently sprang from their clannishness, specifically their tendency to act together, to vote together, and to patronize only Mormon establishments. Leading directly to Smith's assassination, according to Remini, were the Mormon leaders' political activities in Nauvoo, which were viewed as extremely dangerous to the citizens of surrounding communities. I mean, this struck at the heart of the accepted, American ideal of the separation of church and states, which was enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Specifically, Smith had built a theocratic dictatorship in Nauvoo, guarded by the Nauvoo Legion, a standing army of 5,000 heavily armed men whose very existence terrorized the Gentiles. The last straw, as Remini succinctly points out, was Smith's 1844 campaign for president, whereby many non-Mormons felt that he had become a menace to freedmen everywhere and had to be eliminated. As Remini perceptively notes, mixing religion and politics can have disastrous consequences and release forces that tarnish the most cherished ideals of American justice. With balance and sensitivity, Remini then sums up, near the end of his book, the multifaceted personality and significance of Joseph Smith in the following evocative way. I think it kind of gets at the heart of the whole book. As a prophet, Joseph was burdened by many human frailties. He craved recognition and appreciation of his work. Shrewd and even cunning at times, he was a proud man who knew his own worth, yet suffered many moments of insecurity and self-doubt. At once kind and generous toward others, he also scrambled after material gain for himself and his church. He had a deeply controlling temperament and brooked no opposition to his leadership. An optimist, he remained steadfast in his belief, in his beliefs to the end, despite repeated reversals and defeats. In him, strains of egotism, pragmatism, courage, gentleness, pretension, and jealousy were blended together. A man of little formal education, but of striking intellectual power, he produced a vast amount of religious writing that has influenced millions around the world. I mean, he just says so much in that paragraph, and he says it so well, just kind of summing up the Joseph's personality. I mean, that just really, as I say, gets to the heart of what he's trying to say in his book. Remini's biography, despite its strengths, is not without its flaws, however. Among the most significant, in my opinion, is his failure to utilize critical primary sources on Joseph Smith and his close associates, as contained mainly in the LDS Historical Archives in Salt Lake City and in the RLDS, or now the Community of Christ Archives in Independence, Missouri. Instead, Remini has relied on secondary sources in producing a brief a synthesis relying on other individuals. These include the published writings of Joseph Smith himself, and he relies particularly heavily on Lucy Mack Smith's biographical sketches of Joseph Smith. Remini, moreover, relied on information from the biographies of the Mormon leader written by others, including Fawn Brody, Richard L. Bushman, Donna Hill, and Heidi S. Swenton. He also drew information from the published works of a number of other scholars, specifically Richard Lloyd Anderson, Leonard Arrington, Melvin P. V. Backman, D. Michael Quinn, and Grant Underwood. So, he does go to the secondary sources, but I think there is still, he admitted to me personally, he said, well, I never really looked at any primary sources at all. I never visited the church archives. He told me in private conversation and that. I was kind of astounded when he told me that. Remini's work also suffers from, some specific shortcomings as I see it. Particularly weak, and I think really, really weak, is his discussion of Mormon polygamy. The author is inaccurate in his statement that most of Joseph Smith's plural wives were teenagers. Confusing is his conjecture concerning the number of plural wives that Smith actually had. and he kind of jumps all over the place on this. In one place, he says, well, the exact figure is still debated, but at least 27, according to one Mormon historian. I'm quoting Remini here. And then he goes on to state, other historians have guessed that Smith had a number of wives that might have been as low as a few or as high as 84. And so there's kind of a, you know, kind of a zigzag confusion there. Remini's confusion, I think, stems from the simple fact, the simple fundamental fact, that he failed to consult or is even aware of the most recent scholarship on the topic of Mormon polygamy, specifically Lawrence Foster's Religion and Sexuality, which was published all the way back in 1981, or of Carmen Hardy's Solemn Covenant, which the Mormon Polygamous Passage, which was published back in 1992, and especially and particularly, I wish Todd were here. I think he's in another session, but especially and particularly Todd Compton's meticulously researched work in Sacred Loneliness, the definitive work on Joseph Smith and polygamy, the Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, which was published in 1997. Compton, as those of us who have read the work are well aware, has done meticulous research and has been able, through that meticulous research, to narrow the estimates of Joseph's plural wives to between 38 and 40 women. Furthermore, of that total that Compton has come up with, just 10 were teenagers at the time of their marriage to Joseph Smith. So, you know, there's that but also problematic, I feel, and I'm very sensitive to this issue because of my own work, is Remini's error-filled treatment of race slavery and the changing status of African Americans within Mormonism. The author, and I'm kind of revisiting some of the things I did in my earlier session, the author mistakenly states that the printing house and the press at Independence, Missouri were destroyed after printing a pro-abolitionist article in July 1833, whereas actually the Latter-day Saints at that time were not pro-abolitionists, but they were actually anti-abolitionist. Anti-mob violence in this instance was due to the publication of an article entitled Free People of Color in the church-owned newspaper Evening and Morning Star. This particular article outlined the necessary procedures for the migration of free African-American Latter-day Saints into Missouri, which at that time was the location of Mormonism's Zion. And in fact, that article explicitly states that we are opposed to the liberation of black slaves. As you know, in outlining these procedures, we remained opposed to black abolition. And so it's rather curious that he put that kind of a spin on it. Also confusing, Remini also has problems with his discussion of the controversial practice of black priesthood denial itself. The author is confusing in suggesting, and inaccurate, I should say, is confusing in his suggestions of a link between Joseph Smith's Book of Abraham and the now defunct practice. In the words of Remini, I'm quoting Remini, the Book of Abraham verse that the Pharaoh of Egypt is as a descendant of Ham could not hold the priesthood later justified church policy of denying the priesthood to blacks since they were supposedly descended from Ham. Actually, Mormon black priesthood denial was not implemented until 1847, from the earliest evidence that I've come up with, and not by Joseph Smith, but rather Brigham Young, some 3 years after the Mormon prophet's death. This practice, moreover, emerged in a complex, tangled fashion. Historically documented in the studies done by Lester Bush, Armin Moss, and incidentally myself, none of which are cited in Remini's brief and limited bibliography. As for the Book of Abraham, getting back to the Book of Abraham problem, it was not utilized. I mean, Smith wrote that, and those, you know, that he wrote it or translated it, however you believe it. That phrase in there about the Pharaoh's descendants being cursed as pertaining to the priesthood, this was not utilized as a scriptural proof text until many years after Joseph Smith's death. It wasn't even canonized as official church scripture until 1880. These significant problems notwithstanding, Robert V. Remini's Joseph Smith is an important work, deserving the attention of scholars and interested lay readers concerned with Mormon studies. On the positive side, Remini's biography is a readable revisionist account that can be compared and contrasted with Fawn Brody's critical No Man Knows My History. And I might say that he's no Fawn Brody. I knew Fawn Brody. Fawn Brody was a friend of mine. I knew her very well. And you know, I mean, that's one of the things that's clear about this work. Or it can also be, you know, it can also be used in conjunction with other more recent positive accounts, Donna Hill and Richard Bushman. In fact, Remini admitted himself, he leaned quite heavily on Bushman's book on Joseph Smith, his first volume. He told me that, and Bushman confirmed that when we talked at last year's Sunstone in Salt Lake City, which some of you might have been to when they gave that panel. Despite its skilled, lively style, I say it's really written in a very, very skilled and a very lively style, Remini's various errors of fact and interpretation shows that much remains to be done in probing the life and times of Joseph Smith. The most important, and I would say, and I would add this because I know this from my own research, the most important but also the most elusive of Latter-day Saints, indeed the truly definitive biography of Mormonism's founder, remains to be written. And I guess there are other couple of other people that are in this process. Bushman himself is supposed to have a biography. And I understand Vogel. I think Vogel, Dan Vogel, is working on a biography as well. Yeah. And there's that three. Yeah, right, Will. There's a three volume thing that is Vogel a contributor in that series? I know that Van Wagner is doing a volume, and I know that Marty Bradley's doing a volume. It's a three volume biography. That's right. Thanks for reminding me that. So Scott Kenny, it's going to be a three volume biography. Thanks for reminding me about that. That's going to be an important work, and I think it's supposed to be due out at approximately 2005. You know, in time for the 200th anniversary of Joseph. So you know, I think we're all eagerly awaiting you know, those four books. You know, I know I am for one. Vogel, I guess, has actually edited those documents, which again. Remini didn't make any reference to all the writings of Joseph. Well, let me move on because I know the part that Will is anxious to hear. he's got his knife sharpened there. Okay. In contrast to Remini's Joseph Smith, Will Bagley's Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young, and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows is not a biography per se. And maybe it's unfair for me to. You know, go in that direction, but I'm going to do that anyway. You know, because I'm interested in the biographical sketches that he produces. Because you know, Brigham Young is highlighted. He's highlighted as a central figure in Bagley's important work. As Will carefully notes in his notes, his study, and he notes this at the beginning, is neither a complete biography of Brigham Young nor a comprehensive history of the LDS Church, stating carefully at the beginning that Mountain Meadows was but a single incident in the long career of the Mormon leader, correctly characterizing Young a complex man who must be recognized for his many achievements. Bagley appears to suggest, appears to confess, grudging respect for the Mormon leader, whom he describes as one of the most remarkable Americans of any age. At the same time, Bagley characterizes the Mountain Meadows Massacre a watershed event in the life of Brigham Young and for the larger Mormon church, a watershed event. And so, you know, he's done all that work and spent all that effort. And I agree with him. I think it was a watershed event in Brigham Young's life and in the history of the Mormon church. I have no question about that. Particularly compelling is Bagley's discussion of Joseph Smith's influence on Brigham Young as the Mormon prophet's successor. Young was disheartened by the murder of his beloved friend, Joseph Smith, but determined to carry on his legacy. Actually, I think he maybe overstates the term beloved friend, because I got the sense they weren't all that close, you know. I mean, actually, Young or Smith tended to be closer to other people, and some of the scoundrels like John C. Bennett, you know, and he was, and if at a time he was closer to Rigdon. I think, you know, that's kind of maybe a post, you know, post-mortem retrospective that Brigham Young and others like to think they were much closer than they actually were. So I don't think they were really, you know, that's at least the sense I get, because, you know, he dispatches Young to England as you know, and for missionary work over there, but anyway, that I don't want to be nitpicking there. Young's determination, you know, and again I'm quoting Bagley, Young's determination to complete the work of Joseph Smith by any cost and by any means created a culture of violence, according to Bagley. But at the same time, Young was never comfortable with his role as a prophet. Again, these are the words of Will. And he felt caught. He felt caught in this role. Young's religious insights, moreover, lacked the certainty of Joseph Smith's personal conversations with the Lord. Instead, uncharacteristic hesitation marked Young's conduct. How would he lead the saints if he could not speak with God face to face, as Smith had done? This problem was resolved in what Bagley describes, I think, in one of the most remarkable parts of this book. This is the part that really jumped out at me, in what Will describes as a powerful personal epiphany, vision, or dream, wherein Young confronted and talked with the dead departed Smith. This supernatural event occurring in February 1847 at Winter Quarters. And this is, I'm quoting here from Bagley's book. Brigham Young found Joseph Smith sitting near a bright window. Taking Smith's hand and kissing him on both cheeks, Young asked, "Why could we not be together as we once were?" Smith told him, "It was all right that they should not be together yet." The dead seer addressed the question that most troubled his disciple: how to be a prophet and keep the Spirit of the Lord. The mind of man must be open to receive all spirits in order to be prepared to receive the Spirit of the Lord, he advised. When the still small voice speaks, always receive it. Smith gave Young a sweeping vision of the plan of salvation. When it ended, Joseph was in the edge of the light, but where I had to go was as midnight darkness. Young told his fellow apostles to remember his dream, for it was a vision of God and received through the Spirit of Joseph. I think that's one of the most evocative parts, for me anyway, of Will's biography. That really stands out to me. This profound experience, in the words of Bagley, resolved Brigham Young's doubts about his role as Joseph Smith's heir. It gave him the confidence he needed to lead the saints and inspired his belief that God had called him to implement Smith's vision. A new dynamism and conviction replaced Young's self-doubt and hesitation, for he believed God would inspire and direct his actions. Bagley, however, is confusing in other places in assessing the significance of this event. The author, in fact, asserts that Young's self-doubts remain strong throughout the course of his life, which I have a little bit of a problem there. Young's deep-seated insecurities, according to Bagley, prompted Young to make greater spiritual and economic demands of his followers and to habitually blame others for his own mistakes and bad decisions. I agree that Young had this weakness, but whether that weakness was due to his insecurity or to other pathological issues, I don't know. His insecurity about his role as a prophet and total devotion to the most radical doctrines of Joseph Smith also led to provocative acts that had their fateful consequences for his people. And, of course, Bagley here is alluding to the Mount Middle Massacre. Young, in the words of Bagley, was never comfortable with his role as prophet. And I beg to disagree with that. Upon being sustained, and I don't know if you've got the right date here or not, upon being sustained as prophet, seer, and revelator in October 1857, I just wonder if that should be October 1847. It's on page 39, unless this was a re-sustaining. This was a re-sustaining him. Right, yeah, okay. This is correct date, 1857. Young said, this was 10 years later.
They didn't sustain with that in 1847. They first do it about...
Yeah, okay. Okay, and then in 1857, so this makes it even a little bit more problematic that it's a later date, because Young said at that time in 1857, titles always make me feel as though I'm called more than I am deserving of. I am Brigham Young, an apostle of Joseph Smith, and also of Jesus Christ. So I think by 10 years after he, you know, that had led the saints to Utah, I think he overstates his insecurities in that regard. All this being said, I feel that Will overstates his case concerning the nature and the depth of Brigham's insecurities. Bagley is more convincing. I think Will is more convincing in discussing Young's qualities as a pragmatic leader. Here I tend to agree with that assumption pretty much so, and I found it in my own research. And Brigham Young's pragmatism persuaded him to keep his options open, always maintaining a contingency plan in case his prophetic powers failed him. And I think that's a very keen and I think a very succinct, very valid insight. Young's pragmatism was evident during the difficult period of the 1850s, as the Mormon leader considered various options relative to Mormonism's permanent gathering place. During the famine of 1855, Young considered abandoning the Great Basin and moving the entire church to San Bernardino. But concurrently, these same desperate economic conditions fueled a new drive for statehood. On a grander scale, Young envisioned Mormon control of the whole North American continent. This is kind of building on some of the things that Joseph Smith had also talked about during his lifetime. Young summed up his various options, quote, "I say, as the Lord lives, we are bound to become a sovereign state in the Union or as an independent nation by ourselves. And let them, the enemies of the church, drive us from this place if they can. They cannot do it." I can't do as well as Will can. Particularly thoughtful and engaging is Will's excellent account of Brigham Young's complex attitudes and multifaceted relationship with Native Americans, which the author develops throughout the study. I think it's one of the strengths of the book. I encountered the same issue of Young's relationship with the Indians, and it just astounds me that somebody hasn't done a definitive study of Brigham Young and the Indians or the church at that time. You know, I think it just astounds me that hasn't been done. I mean, people have done bits and pieces of that, but I think Will has brought up some you know, an outline of good suggestions of things that could be followed. According to Will, Young led the way in asserting that the Indians, among whom the Latter-day Saints had settled, were the literal descendants of the Book of Mormon Lamanites, and thus shared the blood of Israel with the Mormons, and were destined to assist them, the Latter-day Saints, in the conflicts that would precede the return of Christ. I think it's very evocative. It sums up a lot of what was involved with Mormon interaction and relations and attitudes toward the Indians. Or, as colorfully stated by Bagley, American Indians as, quote, the so-called stick of Joseph would be the Mormons' most powerful allies and fearsome weapon, the battle axe of the Lord. At the same time, Young preached that the Indians must be saved, for they are the children of Abraham. To further this end, in fulfillment of Book of Mormon prophecy, Young predicted that the elders would marry wives of every tribe of Indians, enabling the Lamanites to become a white and delightsome people. in further pursuit of this goal of Mormon eugenics, Young advised his followers to buy up Lamanite children as fast as they could, educate them and teach them the gospel so that many generations would not pass ere they should become a white and delightsome people, unquote. Negative aspects of Mormon Indian relations are also carefully chronicled by Will. Quote, Brigham Young's regrettable strategy of selective extermination ultimately challenged their very survival. Young's Indian policy, essentially an open hand and mailed fist approach, gave the Indians the choice of becoming enemies or dependent clients of the Mormons. To make matters worse, Brigham Young's tenure as Utah Territorial Superintendent of Indian Affairs was riddled with corruption, but with a twist, in that the Mormon leader never spent a dollar on the Indians in Utah except to wage war against them or to promote the interests of his church, unquote. Young, moreover, clashed with federally appointed Indian agent Garland Hurt over Indian policy. Hurt, acting against Young's wishes, promoted a policy of large farms for the Utes designed to eliminate the tribe's dependency on local white Mormon population. So I really think that he's said a lot there and kind of outlined some direction in which future studies, you know, kind of a little bit of a synthesis. I mean, he relies on other scholars like Floyd O'Neill and Howard Christie and, you know, other people that have, so, you know, he's done a good job of bringing some of those complex, that complex layering of attitudes and practices together. And that's done throughout the book. But Will is much less satisfactory in his discussion of the complex, tangled relationship between Brigham Young and John D. Lee, a complex, a key figure involved in the Mountain Meadow Massacre. In places, the author's discussion is confusing and less than convincing. In noting that Lee was adopted as a son into the family of Brigham Young in December 1845, Bagley appears to downplay the significance of this event. And I'm quoting Bagley here. Through the law of adoption, virtually every priesthood member was adopted into the extended families of Mormon authorities. Thus, Lee was merely one of 38 men sealed to Young as sons. However, Bagley then goes on to note that Lee himself attached great importance to this act, claiming to be Young's first adopted son. And you talk about, well, he was actually second, but anyway. And actually began signing his correspondence, J. D. L. Young, John D. Lee Young. A more serious deficiency is Bagley's vagueness in outlining the dynamics of the Young-Lee relationship. Left unanswered for me was precisely what brought the two men together in the first place. A second question not sufficiently answered is, what bound these two together through good times as well as bad? Bagley does note that a crucial point of contact was that both Young and Lee were romantically attracted to the same woman, namely one Emmeline Free. Lee actually met Emmeline first, falling in love with her and becoming engaged to her in late 1845. Shortly thereafter, Young met Emmeline and, much to Lee's dismay, also fell in love with her. At this critical juncture, Young promised Lee that if he would surrender Emmeline, Young, in compensation, would uphold Lee in time and eternity, and he should never fall, and that he, Lee, would sit at Young's right hand in his kingdom, referring to the hereafter, I would assume. Despite its grand theological implications, Young's offer tormented Lee, for he loved Emmeline dearly. But in the end, Lee gave in to Young's wishes. Ultimately, Emmeline became one of Young's favorite wives, bearing him a total of 10 children. I think that was the most of any wife, as I recall, in my own own study. In his account, Bagley appears to suggest, without saying so directly, that Young's courtship and marriage to Emmeline Free was linked to his decision to adopt John D. Lee as a son. He doesn't come right out and say it, but it seems to be implied. This same incident might have also influenced Young's willingness to include Lee in his inner circle through membership in the extensive, all-important in Mormon millennialistic plans to establish their temporal kingdom of God. The dynamics of the Young-Lee relationship continued in the years following the Mormon migration to the Great Basin. Even though Lee was prone to erratic, often excessive behavior, making it somewhat of a loose cannon. I mean, that's my term. I don't think Will used it in his book. This was evident. But it's a good, but you like the term? Okay. This evident in several incidents described in Bagley's narrative. And let me quote Bagley again. Lee's domineering personality spawned speculation about his business dealings and sexual habits. Lee was a swindler in dealing, a liar in conversation, and low, sensual brute of a man who had 8 wives living with him in a home that was little better than a house of ill fame, unquote. So not much to say good about that, is there? Particularly intriguing and indeed perplexing about the Young-Lee relationship is the remarkable fact that Lee, despite his erratic, excessive personality, and despite being made the sole scapegoat for the Mountain Meadows Massacre, I think it's a significant, did not implicate Brigham Young as an accessory before the fact. This is evident in the confessions that Lee penned just prior to his execution in February 1877, wherein he blamed the Indians, thereby, quote, shifting primary responsibility away from both the LDS Church and himself. As for Brigham Young's response, Bagley, in a most revealing, again evocative account, notes that the Mormon leader, upon receiving word in the wake of John D. Lee's execution, that the condemned man had, quote, remained true to the church, he, Young, fell on his knees and cried like a baby. Then Young allegedly remarked that, quote, and I think it's an interesting quote because there's an interpretation here. John D. Lee always told me he would stand between me and the mouth of the cannon, but I was afraid he would falter when it came to the test, unquote. All of this brings me to the central focus of Will's book. Was Brigham Young indeed an accessory before the fact? I must confess that Will presents a convincing case. According to him, the fate of the Fancher Party was sealed in a September 1st, 1857 meeting in Great Salt Lake between the leaders of the Southern Paiute Indian bands and Brigham Young, whom the Indians addressed, and I've never heard this expression, addressed as Big Hum. Yeah, it's spelled B-I-G-U-M. I have to see it in print because I get appreciate the. But anyway, present at the meeting were various tribal leaders who were said to have been at the massacre, this according to Will. These events took place against the backdrop of the Utah War and the dispatch of federal troops to Utah. Brigham Young warned U.S. Army Captain Stuart Van Velt, sent ahead to Salt Lake City ahead of the troops to meet with Brigham Young. He warned Van Velt, quote, if the government dare force the issue, I shall not hold the Indians by the wrist any longer. If the issue comes, you may tell the government to stop immigration across the continent, for the Indians will kill all who attempt it, unquote. In elaborating on the role of the Indians, Brigham Young stated in a significant and important 12th September 1857 letter, And this is really a key quote here. The Czech reign has broken, and cousin Lemuel is out at large. In fact, he has already been collecting some of his annuities. Day after day, I am visited by their chiefs to know that they may strike while the iron is hot. If President Buchanan does not deal justly with the Mormons, the war cry shall resound from the real Colorado to the headwaters of the Missouri, from the Black Hills to the Sierra Nevadas. Travel will be stopped across the continent. The deserts of Utah become a battleground for freedom. It is peace and the Mormons' rights, or the knife and tomahawk. Let Uncle Sam choose, unquote. Bagley succinctly sums up what he claims were Young's mixed feelings about the massacre after it occurred. Young, according to Bagley, characterized it a righteous and necessary act of vengeance that confirmed his hope that the Lamanites were ready to take up their role as the battle axe of the Lord and help usher in the millennium. But he recognized the peril to him and the Latter-day Saints' cause if word leaked out that the Mormons had joined the Indians in the slaughter of an entire wagon train, unquote. At the same time, Bagley asserts that Young felt that this was the most unfortunate event that ever befell the church. As for Bagley's basic contention that Brigham Young was an accessory before the fact in the events leading up to Mountain Meadows Massacre, this reviewer, I remain unconvinced. In defense of Bagley's position, Brigham Young, through his rhetorical statements, clearly contributed to a culture of violence and millennialistic fervor during the Utah War, a time of extreme tension. In this explosive environment, it seems clear that the Mormon leader encouraged general acts of Indian deprivation along the Overland Trail. Bagley, however, has failed to make a convincing case as to how and why Brigham Young would single out the Fancher Party in particular for destruction. Bagley's evidence notwithstanding, the author, in this reviewer's opinion, has not sufficiently proven his case that Brigham Young, as an accessory before the fact, specifically ordered the massacre of the Fancher Party at Mountain Meadows. Also, there is the problem of motive, and this is a centerpiece of Bagley's work, to avenge the blood of the prophets, which he took as the title of his work, specifically of slain apostle Parley P. Pratt. Here I also find Bagley's Will's evidence both tenuous and unconvincing. As I said before, Bagley, Will is correct in his discussions of the heightened tensions and within the LDS community as the federal armies approached Utah, particularly on a grassroots level, combined with the white-hot fervor. I haven't mentioned this, the white-hot fervor stirred up by the Mormon Reformation. There was those embers, even though I think Jedediah Grant was dead by this time, wasn't he? When did he die? Yeah, but Jedediah, when did Jedediah Grant, he was the leader of that. No, December 1856, okay. But the white heart fervor of the Mormon Reformation, all this created a heightened sense of millennialistic expectations, a mood of urgency, which was further fanned by the inflammatory rhetoric of Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. This, in turn, inspiring local Mormon leaders to act against the Fancher Party, which unfortunately happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I feel that Bagley, and I get a little happy on a more positive note. I'm going to. I'm a compassionate soul, Okay. Bagley is on much. Will is on much firmer ground in capturing the essence of Brigham Young's personality, thus providing keen insights into the complex, multifaceted individual that he was. I must confess that Bagley's critical, hard-edged presentation has caused me to rethink some of my own preconceived notions concerning the Mormon leader. Even here, I feel that Bagley's portrait is somewhat skewed and distorted, a bit too much to the negative side. I feel there's a pitfall in focusing on a negative event in any individual's life or background. And I have to confess, I did the same thing when I wrote my Saints, Slaves, and Blacks. I was appalled. I was disgusted by Brigham Young's racism, and because it stood in sharp contrast to the much more charitable attitudes and the much more enlightened attitudes of Joseph Smith. And I can remember feeling a sense of moral outrage. And so, after I got through writing that book, which was published, and in fact, that Will doesn't decide his bibliography, which had been nice, but after I'd finished that book, I decided, I wanted to go on and look at the whole man, and so I ended up for the next three or four years, looking at the whole personality of Brigham Young, and what I came up with was my Brigham Young and the Expanding American Frontier, again, which Will does not cite. If I don't know if he felt that it was not it was redundant with Arrington's or what it was. But my view of Brigham Young in this book was much more favorable than it was in Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, because I was dealing more with the total man. And so that's the pitfall, and maybe it's a little bit unfair for me to focus on that, because all this being said, Bagley's acute portrait will hopefully stimulate renewed scholarly interest in the Mormon leader, building upon Leonard Arrington's 1985 magnum opus, Brigham Young, American Moses. While Arrington's biography was certainly a seminal work for its time, it was far, far from definitive. I know Will will agree with me on that. We've talked about this before. Arrington failed to utilize, I think on a basic level, I think, Arrington had a little bit of the same problem that Remedy did. He failed to master or to utilize the primary essential sources then available. And they were right there sitting in the church archives, and when he was supposedly working on this biography. And so he didn't really, and there's a massive amount of material, but I found that he most of the things that he cited were from already published things. That was one of the things that amazed me about Arrington's book when it came out. More problematic, I felt, though, about Arrington's book was his basic interpretation, which I feel was overly positive. I felt like I was a little bit harder on Brigham. I don't know if you've read it, and I don't know if you agree with me or not.
Too hard on Brigham.
We're going to have an interesting discussion. Okay. Well, but I feel that the reason that Arrington was overly positive is this was reflective. I think every biography reflects the time in which it was written. It was reflective of the time that it was written, which was a more optimistic, open time for Mormon study. The so-called Mormon Camelot. This was a time when, the Camelot period, which Arrington himself promoted and fought vainly to preserve. Now, in this much different time, September 6th, and I'm not speaking of, the post September 6th, 93. I think we live in much different times, and so we tend to look at our leaders and look at the church in a much more critical light. And so I think this makes it essential that an extensive biographical reexamination is in order. As in the case of Joseph Smith, the truly definitive biography of Brigham Young, I really feel, remains to be written. Thank you. I went on too long, probably.
I think I'll start with a Newell Bringhurst anecdote. And it goes back to the first days as I began deciding that I was not going to become a novelist. I had better talents as a historian. And I decided I was going to write a biography of a book. And I picked No Man Knows My History because I think it's a very influential book in the history of Mormonism. And I felt, too, that Brody's life raised a number of significant issues about Mormonism. So I began going through her papers and contacted a few of her children. And everywhere I'd go, people said to me, well, Newell Bringhurst is working on a biography of her. And finally, I ran into a key problem, which I thought Newell addressed in the biography fairly well. And some reactions from the family that I decided, I'm going to write about dead people. And at the same time, I'd developed an interest in Samuel Brannan. And so I began going into the sources on Samuel Brannan, and every place I went, people would tell me, Newell Bringhurst is writing a biography of Samuel Brannan. And I decided, well, the hell with it. I'm going to do it first. And there's a lesson there for any historians, which is nobody owns a subject. And the more people that look at a subject, the better off we're going to be. Although the field in Mountain Meadows is, I admit, getting a little bit crowded. Well, some are. But anyway, I was going to read the introduction of Brigham Young, but Newell summarized the cases pretty well. I'll read this paragraph, which is in the introduction to Brigham Young in the book. And it's a picture of him in 1844, just as he begins signing documents as president of the church, although he was merely president of the 12 apostles. Brigham Young was just the man for the moment. Handsome, he was youthful, handsome, and attractive. Of middle height, clean-shaven, and a surprisingly dapper dresser, with shoulder-length, sandy red hair. His lack of formal education made him contemptuous of intellectual pretensions, but his blue-gray eyes reflected a sharp, practical intelligence. Unlike the visionary Smith, he was not naturally charismatic, and his leadership was forceful and pragmatic. His only canonized revelation dictated the organization of the Mormon immigration. He was passionately devoted to the martyred prophet, and his life's work became carrying out the martyred prophet's plans. And that I think sort of set the tone of the approach that I wanted to take to dealing with Brigham Young, which I felt had to be fair, and I had to look at the evidences, and that the best way to create Brigham Young in a believable fashion on this particular subject was to quote him, was to let him speak for himself. And my natural inclination as a historian is to present the primary evidence and let readers come to their own conclusions. And I was fortunate to work with arguably the best editor in Western history, Chuck Rankin at Oklahoma. And Chuck would say, no, look, some of this stuff's so complex, you've got to step back and at the beginning of a chapter, explain to the reader why it's important and what it means. And so I abandoned the style that I really learned from David Bigler and began doing more exposition and trying to summarize this complex evidence in a fair way so that readers could interpret it better. But I also was committed to not writing a polemic because I believed it would be self-defeating. And that's why I was so pleased to get this invitation from the editors of True West, because it let me write a polemic. And remind me when I wrap up to go back to why I think Mormon critics typically react to the book the way they do. And one other introductory anecdote, which is I haven't read Remini's book, which I understand is very good, and I'll take side bets that it will be the book of the year or get the best book award at Mormon History Association next month. I think it'll be any port in a storm.
You can bet which one won't get.
Well, I don't think I can get any takers on that. But anyway, I confess, I walked into a Sunstone session on Brigham Young's biographers, which, you know, Sunstone does some great stuff. And I was only able to stay for like 2 minutes, and I walked in, and Remini was talking about how he did the research for his Joseph Smith book. He said, he was going on effusively about how he was welcomed at Brigham Young University and how great the Brigham Young guys were to him and what a great service Richard Bushman had done in guiding him through the understanding. And he said, the folks at BYU did all my research. And so I haven't felt compelled to read the book. But I don't think anyone will complain that that's a flaw in my book. I did my own research on this one. Now, in terms of Newell's critique, I really appreciate it. I thought it was very good, very balanced. I was especially impressed by how insightful he was about what I thought were some of the most significant innovations in the book, and new ways of looking at Brigham Young, which I'm astonished that no one has ever really dealt with. If you go to Leonard Arrington, you will not find a mention of the 1847 February vision of Joseph Smith. It's extraordinary, but there are a number of things in Arrington's book that simply aren't there that make you wonder, well, what was going on? And I think partly it was the nature of the way the book was written, which was not by Leonard Arrington, but by committee. And subsequently, and it's interesting because I began to see things come out, and some of them actually came out in anticipation of my book from BYU scholars addressing some of these issues. I think partly because they were aware that this was going to come and they'd better quit ducking it. Ron Walker recently did a long article in Ensign or something on how Joseph Smith had this vision of Brigham Young and how important it was. Or Brigham Young had a vision of Joseph Smith and how important it was. This was one of two elements I missed when I did Pioneer Camp of the Saints, the Thomas Bullock official journal of the Brigham Young Pioneer Company. The other point I missed, and I think this would have been useful to reinforce my view of how Brigham Young acted as a prophet, was the May 28th revelation. I'll bet you none of you knew that on the Overland Trail, Brigham Young had a revelation, and it said, it's right before he goes in and chews everybody out for playing cards and being lax, really dresses him down. Well, the revelation says, this whole operation is in danger of going to rack and ruin. And if it does go to hell, it's not Brigham Young's fault, it's your fault. Now that, to me, reflects a huge amount of insecurity. It also reflects how responsible Brigham Young felt in his role as the leader, and how terrified he was of being called on it, of failing, of his prophecies going awry. And that's why I think if you look closely at Brigham Young's career as a prophet, you'll see he really does back off from claiming that as a role. He becomes president of the church. He's the official leader. But he, much as Joseph Smith in his later years, made Hiram the prophet, or is Sidney Rigdon the prophet for a while? Smith gets very leery of the prophet business and sort of begins shifting it off to other people. Young only claims the title, I think, in either 48 or 51 after he's actually been confirmed as the president of the church. And so he eventually works his way into all the offices of Brigham Young. But I saw Brigham Young as basically an insecure character. And to me, this explained running roughshod over people, the bullying. Brigham Young is not a nice guy. When you get down to it, he abuses people. He ridicules his most devoted associates. He is exacting. He is financially ruthless. If you lent money to Brigham Young, you learned never to ask for it back. Because if you did, you were in big, big trouble. And when Brigham Young died, the Mormon people, my ancestors, were living in poverty. There was a high crust on Mormon elite, but most of the people were living in abject poverty. And when Young died in 1877, dollars, his estate was worth $600,000 to $2 million. The bottom figure today would be equivalent to $10 million. And that did not come, as Brigham Young would say, by his own hard work. It came because he was a miser. And he cheated people out of property and money and ran roughshod on them. And I believe that the evidence is there. He was a political tyrant. You know the great move south where the Mormon people proved their devotion to Brigham Young? By packing up in the middle of spring planting, at the end of a two-year famine. They all, at Brigham Young's orders, pack up and move to the southern valleys to show basically who's boss and show how devoted the people are to them. Look closely at the facts. The federal commissioners who had come out to present an ultimatum to Brigham Young of we've got a pardon for treason. You can take it or leave it. And Brigham Young took it. But the commissioners estimated that one-third of the people who were forced to move from northern Utah did so at gunpoint, that Young used the militia to force them to do it. And that imposed a level of suffering that was totally unnecessary and totally unjustified, because it served one purpose, to let Aunt Alfred Cumming know who was boss. And it worked. And Brigham Young found the perfect foil in Aunt Alfred Cumming, who was, to use a phrase another historian has applied to another character, a skin full of putty, a coward. And he is always celebrated in Mormon annals for his being fair and celebrating the rights of the Mormons. He was a coward. He was simply intimidated and bullied into doing what he knew was wrong. And finally, at the end of his career as governor of Utah Territory, he recognized that he'd been taken to the cleaners. Thomas Kane told Brigham Young in spring of 1858, after manipulating Kane to become sympathetic to the Mormons, he said, "I have caught the fish. I will let you cook him." And Brigham Young cooked Alfred Cumming. But I explained this kind of behavior as a basic insecurity complex. I did, however, have an interesting conversation with a friend of many of us who's a psychiatrist at UCLA. And I explained my psychological model of Brigham Young to him. And he said, "Well, I disagree. I think Brigham Young was just that way. He was just mean. He just had this huge confidence in himself, and he didn't have a single doubt. He was just ornery, and he was not going to be—he was not going to let anybody bamboozle him or get in his way." And I personally thought that was a pretty unfair view of him. But the thing is, there's no way to make either case. They're both psychological interpretations for which the evidence supports both of them, I think, equally well. But I did try to be very fair to Brigham Young. Early on, I came across a piece of evidence in Hutchings Illustrated Magazine, a famous California newspaper, published about 1860. And it said that at a ball in the Beehive House, or the Lion House, Brigham Young went up to Eleanor McLean Pratt, the widow of Parley P. Pratt, and told her that he was glad Parley was dead. And I thought, now that's a great story, and that really would help, you know, improve, or help add color to this book and thesis. But I said, it's so unfair to Brigham Young. That is such a brutal, callous act that, and since I don't have a good source on it, I don't have anything to corroborate that. I said, you can't use it. It's just not the quality of evidence that you need to have to back it up. And it reflects so badly on Brigham Young, it'll look as if it was just used gratuitously. And I know that Mormon critics, 2 weeks after the book came out, I got an article saying, well, Brigham Young really didn't like Parley P. Pratt, and therefore he wouldn't have avenged him. And they cited some quotes from the Woodruff Diary that I missed. But also, John Peterson informed me that he'd seen a document reporting a minute book saying that when Brigham Young learned of Pratt's murder, he said, Well, that damn fool, I told him not to go out there. He got what he deserved. I think I was right about characterizing the relationship between Pratt and Brigham Young as very uneasy, but however much Brigham Young didn't like Parley P. Pratt, I do not believe for a minute that he would have hesitated to carry out his vow and to do the thing that that Pratt's widow was sitting in his office screaming at him to do. And I think it's interesting, too, because as I worked through the book, I reached a point where I thought, you know, you got two basic interpretations. One is the Brooks. One damn thing leads to another. Brigham Young set it all up, but he didn't realize the consequences or the extent of what would happen, so that you really can't make him an accessory before the fact. And, in fact, it's not a question of accessory. It's a question of murder, felony murder. And the trouble that I think the church biographers will face is it's a question really of the degree of murder. Oh, and let me go back to that in a minute. But I thought I'd never find a piece of evidence that convinced me one way or the other. And I explain what that piece of evidence is in this piece, which I was so pleased to be able to write because I worked very hard to make sure that this book was not a polemic. And Robert Briggs in Sunstone accused the book of being a polemic. I said, Robert, show me one sentence. Show me one piece that is anti-Mormon. And Todd Compton had a very revealing comment to me once. He said, you know, as I read the book, I thought, this book is really anti-Mormon. He said, I finished it, and I went back and I looked for evidences, what I could use to back that up. And he said, I couldn't find any. And he said, as I was reading the book, I thought, this is a profoundly anti-religious book. He said, and then I got to the end and I said, this is a profoundly religious book. And I think it's the nature of the book itself, which is, as Newell pointed out, is hard-edged. But it is not a polemic. And Mormons are used to having you line up on one side of the issue and beat it to death and present all the evidence that supports you and don't even talk about that would call your thesis into question. And both sides do it, you know. There's never an attempt to incorporate the contradictory nature of all historical evidence. And I must say that the fact that when I did find out how Eleanor Pratt got to Utah, I knew what happened. It's a fact that would probably escape most people looking at it, and certainly most readers of the book would go, well, why didn't you make a big deal about it? Well, because my goal, as I say in the front, is to tell the story, to let the story proceed and let people make up their own minds. And I was struck later by how difficult it was to break out of the standard interpretation, the Juanita Brooks model, which is really the Charles Penrose defense, which Ron Walker repeats, regurgitates, word for word, except for some of the more discredited elements of it. But the Penrose defense was really the model with which I started, and I first thing I did was read Brooks, and it was difficult for me to, as a historian, to step away from that and to look at this as any Western historian would. And the Western historians who've come to this come away mad, come away outraged at how misrepresented the history has been in Mormon books. As I began to put all the pieces together, look at all the evidence, and step back, I went, the standard story is preposterous. That these people went through Utah like drunken pirates, and they got the people in southern Utah all pissed off at them, and they got the Indians mad at them, and then the Indians attacked, and the settlers who were threatened by the Indians had to go in and kill all these people. Huh? Step back. That doesn't make sense if you look at who these people were. And it only makes sense the question becomes, how do you get people to murder women and children? How do you get decent, God-fearing men to do that? And the question isn't, well, these people were mean to them, or they called the prophets names. The question becomes fanaticism. It's a religious act. They're in a theocracy where obedience is the first law, where the vows to avenge the blood of the prophets are primary. It is not a political act. In the entire Civil War, no American soldier on either side ever kills a child. So why do 80 children die at Mountain Meadows? It is not a political act. It is not an act of expediency. It is a religiously motivated murder. And it's a hard, hard fact, but I don't see how you get around it. Let me see. Oh, and but the relationship between Lee and Young is very complex. And I just sort of tried to present it as it rolled out. I think the answers are in the evidence. It's the point where I didn't say, why are these guys in this bizarre relationship? Well, partly it was because Brigham Young liked John D. Lee, who'd do exactly what he was told. That was the prime thing you needed to get going with Brigham Young. But at the same time, Lee was devoted. And Lee was the perfect scapegoat. Why? Because Lee didn't get orders. Lee didn't get direct orders. He carried out orders from his militia superiors. And he sticks to that story in his memoir, which is quite interesting, and which I've just recently found a very compelling evidence that it is John D. Lee. But John D. Lee makes no bones about who directed this, who was involved before it happened. And you'll note in the introduction to the Contra in that article that there are certain snide remarks made about conspiracy history. Now, anyone who wants to deal with Mountain Meadows has to deal with this fact. Whenever Brigham Young was first told about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, on June 18th in Provo, Utah, Jacob Hamblin told Brigham Young and George A. Smith all about it. He told them more than he told at the trials of John D. Lee in 1876 when he told the whole grisly story. But as he said then, I told him more because it was closer to the event and I could remember more. 2 months later, George A. Smith goes to southern Utah purportedly to conduct an investigation. The result of that investigation is a letter which is used as the official explanation. It's what's sent to Thomas Kane, who gives it to the president, and it blames it all on the bad conduct of the immigrants and the anger of the Indians. And that, as we now know, is a lie. And that is a conspiracy, no matter how you get around it. And it is a conspiracy to obstruct justice in a murder investigation. And if you do that, if you protect a murderer on whom you have primary evidence, you are not guilty of being accessory to murder. You are guilty of felony murder. Now, so the question becomes not, was Brigham Young a murderer? Did Brigham Young know about it before or after? It's really, what kind of a murderer is he? And it's a hard, hard fact to wrestle with, but that's the terms of the problem. And if anyone wants to write a book that essentially is motivated by trying to clear Brigham Young's skirts of this, while acknowledging, yes, he set it up, yes, he set up conditions to make it possible, yes, he covered it up, yes, he did all this, but he didn't order it. He didn't order it. Well, you know, you can read the evidence both ways, and I didn't say as explicitly as I should have perhaps in the end, but that's where the evidence is. However, if you're going to try to justify this, you're justifying murder. And as Juanita Brooks said, no one can justify murder. Thank you very much. And now you know why this book will not get the Best Book Award.
Thank you very much. We're actually out of time. In fact, we're a little over, so we will have our luncheon now with Robert Kirby, if you signed up for that. That will be in Golden Gate Ballroom B, just over here. Thanks.